This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, how are you doing this evening?
I'm fine. I'm flying solo, it seems.
Yeah, we gave Dr. Lyle a little break because he's been picking up a little bit of slack lately.
Hey, you know, I've been busy moving across the country. It takes a lot of time and energy and resources.
And how are the greener pastures?
They are delightful. It is nice being in a rural area and being able to, you know, hang out with birds. And I just watched four deer stroll across my lawn. And that was very, very exciting. And I'm really happy to be out of the city. Back to my childhood roots of living out in the middle of nowhere.
Probably a little less cold, though, too.
It's pretty cold.
Oh, it is. But not like Alaska cold, right?
You know, it's probably pretty similar, all things. Oh, wow. Like, there are parts of Alaska that are ridiculously cold, but where I grew up, of course, Alaska has its extremes, but on balance, it's probably pretty comparable.
Okay. So I remember the episode where you said that all the girls in middle school stand outside with less clothes on.
Yeah.
Is it like that level cold or?
Yeah, it's like, this is, I don't know, it's probably, it was close to zero this week, and that was about as cold as I think it's going to get all winter. It's hovering sort of 10 to 15, which is pretty typical for an Anchorage winter, but Anchorage is going to have a couple of cold snaps a year that are 20 or even 30, 40 below, which we're not going to see here. So that was when it's 20 below, and you've got girls standing outside and bare legs trying to signal their fitness to the potential mates, that got a little ridiculous.
Well, speaking of signaling fitness, are you watching anything interesting right now?
We're recording this on the 23rd, and they just wrapped the big march against the vaccine mandates that was held in Washington, D.C., which I had hoped to be able to go to in person, since I'm quite a bit closer to it than I was before. Yeah. but it just didn't work out with my schedule and various other demands on my time, so I couldn't make it out there.
Are you implying that this podcast is getting in the way of these protests for you?
It's true. This was one of my pressing obligations today. it was really interesting. It was sort of a mixed bag. You know, you hope with these kinds of events that they are very inclusive, and they tried very hard to be, obviously, I wouldn't say apolitical because it's a very political topic, but they tried to be really inclusive with a bunch of different viewpoints. So you had people that were there for a whole bunch of different reasons, people coming from all sorts of really strong religious backgrounds, you know, people who have suffered vaccine injuries telling their stories, doctors, frontline doctors who are advocating early treatment over vaccines, just a whole medley of things. So, I am sure the stream is available for people to watch. I know Del Bigtree was one of the organizers, and he was streaming it on his channel. So people can find that wherever that's available, probably not on YouTube, I would assume. there were some good speeches. RFK Jr., you know, gave quite a rousing kind of keynote, had a lot of powerful things to say, I thought. And then there were some kookier viewpoints and some problematic characters, but that's how it goes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was just glad to see it happen. Glad to see some political action.
Yeah, if you had to rate, maybe I've just thought about this question on the fly, but if you had to rate the, or if you had to compare the beat your genes kind of mentality with what's going on right now politically, how would you kind of compare the two?
In what way? Like a, how do you beat your genes as far as Band-Aids or?
We're in the face of something that's you feel very strongly about with these vaccine mandates. And you and Dr. Lyle both do, and we've shared you've shared your thoughts here. What can people do to beat their genes in this situation?
Yeah, the main thing that he and I have always come back to when we've talked about this here or elsewhere is the whole position of power question. So, it doesn't matter if your workplace has a vaccine mandate or if your community has some other kind of mandate. If you are in a position of power where you are not affected by that or you're not as affected by it as you otherwise would be, so this is very kind of Harry Brown, How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. If when the world becomes less free, you have to rethink how you're going to find freedom. And sometimes that means taking a really hard look at what it is that you're doing with your life, where you're living, what you're doing for work, and how susceptible that makes you to what other people who are bigger and stronger and more powerful than you in terms of state power. If you're more susceptible to what they're going to tell you to do, then it's time to rethink how you can position yourself in a way that you're not, if that is possible for you, or to some degree, however that is possible for you. If it's something that is important to you, it's not as important to everybody as it is to me. To me, this is it's an incredibly important not just ideological point, but just a on fundamental principle and my sense of what it means to have individual liberty. It's really this is a single issue cause for me. So I'm willing to reorganize my life and uproot myself quite a bit to manage my way around the situation in ways that other people might not be.
Yeah, I remember a few months ago you talked to, you were in Seattle and you couldn't go anywhere because, passports were required everywhere. So you couldn't even like sit down and have a cup of coffee, is it? Or a cup of hot chocolate or
Yeah,
something.
no, Seattle's very very vaccine card segregated. And the point is that it's not, as Doug and I have talked about many times, it's not about COVID. It's not about the vaccine or the boosters or anything like that. It's sort of what it says about the political context in which you are spending your time. If you are living in a city that is willing to impose this sort of thing on you, that is writing on the wall about what your future in that city looks like, and what your the constraints on the choices for your life going forward might look like. And so this should be a wake-up call for people to really take stock of whether that's something that they can tolerate and want to continue to live with or not. So looking, I mean, I'm very sensitized to this because of my background in political science. I look far beyond what the state is doing at any given time, and I look more conceptually at, well, what is it doing and what does that say about what kind of regime I'm living in? What does that mean has suddenly become more likely for me to anticipate down the line, and how can I protect myself from that?
Wow, that's wonderful, Dr. Hawk. Thank you.
It's a, just paranoid survivalist at this point.
Well, it sounds like I mean, a big display for a lot of people in the political sphere is freedom. Is they want to be promoting freedom. I know, I have friends myself. Like I don't want to travel to countries where there's dictatorships or there. It doesn't feel right to support that system. And so, I guess on a smaller scale, the same thing happens in different states here too.
Yeah, and what I think this often kind of gets lost in a bunch of talking points, and people kind of forget what they're actually trying to say here, and what concepts we're really dealing with. But it is, they did cover today really well. Several speakers really made a good point of distinguishing between you have the right, you know, to get on a plane and fly across the country and go visit a friend, and you have a right to go into a restaurant that wants your business, and you have these sort of basic rights as a citizen of the United States that are being slowly transformed into privileges based on the whims of the regime or the sub-regime that has power over you at that time. And so it happens to be related to this particular pandemic and their perception of the dangers therein at this particular moment. And you may or may not agree with that. You may or may not say, okay, well, COVID is a public, you know, it's a significant threat to public health, and some of this limitation and transformation of rights into privileges is warranted. You know, we need to rethink how we're going to manage our public spaces to keep the most people as safe as we can. So that's its own sort of discussion. But the thing that concerns me much further than that is the transformation of rights into privileges in general, and my awareness of how impossible and how unlikely, if not impossible, it is to walk those things back once they've been transitioned.
Yeah, I can't it's think like of very many says, government yeah. programs that have ever walked much back.
Their tendency is to consolidate greater and greater power and control over their citizenry. That is in principle what they would want to maximize. They do not have an inherent interest in your liberty beyond what they're able to control. So given the pretext, given the capacity, they're going to take more and more of that off the table. And so that's where this whole notion that you have to, you have to fight for your space and your freedom from the state, because it's not going to be happily granted to you. Certainly never going to be given back to you not easily once it's been taken.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly appreciate hearing your thoughts on this, Dr. Hawk. It's kind of interesting to hear the take from an evolutionary psychology perspective, because this is a blend, you know, between the clinical parts of, you know, what you learn from other from your clients, and then what's happening in the world, and really appreciate your take on it.
Yeah, I just am very sensitized to political mission creep. So, you know, it's so easily gets caricatured into this sort of, you're anti-vax and you're spewing ideas about liberty and freedom that don't mean anything. And it's like, no, this is the high concept here. There's nothing more important than that. I don't think going too far to say that it's what the country was founded on, and it's an important part of what we might call the American creed. And I'm not ready to let that go. I'm not willing to let that die on my watch. I'm not willing to go forward in a life that just sort of surrenders that to the threat of whatever the state is telling me at any particular moment in time that I need to be afraid of. That is the whole principle of what we are supposed to stand against in the United States. And if you haven't been sort of radicalized in this direction by now in this process, then you're probably not going to be. But in my case, I very much have been, because it's been unfolding in a direction that I would not have anticipated, and at a speed and to a level that I find pretty horrendous.
Well, we will anxiously await the future. But until then, what do you say we get to some questions?
All we can do. Yeah. Anxiously await the future and take active, movement toward participating in your own life in proactive ways as much as you can. So we were just, Doug and I have this other sort of parallel, very political podcast that we do called Hawk Blocked. And we were just talking on the show this week about how, the most important thing to be doing right now is to be investing in community and investing in skills, basic skills, because that's really, that is, without truly going into paranoid prepper survivalism, that you getting yourself in a position of power from the state means that you're able to meet basic needs without the state's help, that you're not in a position where you've lost your business because of a set of mandates and you can't provide for yourself, and therefore you have to get the handout from the state in the form of some kind of universal basic income, which comes attached to a bunch of strings about what kind of citizen you need to be and what kind of politics you need to have and what it's okay to say and what it's not okay to say or do in the public sphere, and what kind of movements you can or can't make. And that's, that's just not an acceptable cost for me. So if you're driven out of your ability to provide for yourself, then okay, well, what do? Then we turn towards something that does look a little bit like off-grid survivalism, in the sense of you're finding out who your neighbors are, you're finding out what kind of skills you can pool together and what kind of problems you can solve, and you're investing in your own health and your own basic skills of living in the world and providing for yourself and your family. So
yeah, I'm like looking up water filters. Well, I'm looking up water filters right now, and well creation. I do have a miter saw though, so I could probably build some tables if needed.
There you go. Till they cut your power. Yeah. Yeah, he was telling me yesterday that there's apparently the state of California is taxing individual solar panels now, which is so you try to go off grid, you try to get self sufficient, and you get some sort of bill from Sacramento. Yeah. So yeah, I mean it's not going to be easy. There's going to be a lot of resistance here, and I don't think we're at the point where people who want to detach themselves from this encroaching sort of state power need to, completely get into a proper mindset and start investing all their money in Bitcoin and getting off the grid and everything. We might head that direction, but I do think people need to start thinking pretty hard about, where does their engagement with the state kind of begin and end, and what is their comfort level with sharing their data and having their movements defined by their local regime.
Well, speaking of extremely local regime, we have our first question has to do with the victim mentality.
Mm.
So perhaps this could be related to the coming crises. But what do you say we go through this one and see what you have to say, Dr. Hawk?
Let's hear it.
Okay, dear doctors, I was listening to episode 267 recently and was particularly interested in knowing more about the victim mentality. For some context, I grew up facing a lot of turmoil. I had a physically and sexually abusive father. I left home and was homeless from 16 to 18 years old. And I dealt with a lot of tumultuous grooming situations at a young age and so forth. However, I was dealing with it really well until 20 years old, when I started to go to therapy, while simultaneously moving to a tiny city that was very into woke culture. I feel as though it may have actually exacerbated my victim mentality, but I'm unsure. I want to know, was the victim mentality trait already integrated within my genetics, or does woke culture and modern therapy have enough influence to exacerbate that mentality? And does it matter the severity of the weight when it comes to coaching yourself to leave the victim mentality?
Yeah, interesting. So you sent me, Nate, this little short video. It doesn't really lend itself to audio very well, so we can't play it in the show, but this little short video of a baby who is completely fine after a superficial injury until his I assume father caretaker sort of exaggerates and starts coddling the baby and saying, oh my gosh, it's okay, it's gonna be okay. And the baby immediately picks up on these signals of, oh, there's an advantage here to kind of playing this up. And I'm going to get more stuff. I'm going to get more pats on the head and maybe some candy. And, I'm going to earn some esteem here essentially by exaggerating the injury. And so when you're asking, you know, is the victim mentality integrated into your genes or is it sort of, created by the cultural context, it's both. It's in everybody. It's in my dogs. I've seen it in my dogs. Sort of the, you know, playing the victim gets them more attention, gets them more sympathy, gets them more stuff. And this is a very, I mean, this serves a important evolutionary purpose, especially with children, where, you know, it's as long as it stays within the bounds of an appropriate reaction. You are being given resources by your family and by your tribal coalition in accordance with your need by signaling that need. And so when you have been harmed, it pays to, you know, if they don't see the harm, you want to communicate it because otherwise you're not being adequately compensated. And so this is deep within all of us, and it's not inherently problematic or pathological. It becomes so when you introduce it to this environmental context and the psychology industrial complex we're going to latch onto this and develop entire systems and bureaucracies and cultural frameworks to reinforce this and to define your reality by it. So you've got this little tendency that you've observed for your entire life. And then you get a therapist who gloms onto it as a mode, as a means for their own job security, because if they can get you to, let's go back to that. That sounds like that was really significant. Like, have you thought about that? Have you thought about how that's affecting your life right now? And suddenly they have generated a bunch of anxiety in you that needs to be unpacked next week. And so that kind of relationship and getting reinforced by everything that you see on Oprah and on social media and just everywhere. I mean, this is the sort of general approach to pop psychology all over, everywhere that you would look. It starts to get to you and you start to think, oh my gosh, you know, I really can't move on with my life until I heal this trauma, until I move on from this. So, you know, people, it sounds like you went through some legitimately horrific stuff. And, you know, I don't want anyone to interpret us as being in a position of, oh, well, you know, toughen up, move on, it's no big deal. Like, you know, we're not trying to deny that happened. But we're trying to position your life now as, you know, someone who had those experiences but is not defined by them, someone who possesses the full resources and capacities and the unwritten future of your life in this moment, and that every moment that you spend looking backwards trying to, quote, heal the past is a moment that is taking you away from building that future. So it's really a inverted way of looking at how to reconcile these sorts of things, and we're not denying that they happen. We're not denying that they had an important role on defining your sense of normal and habituating you to certain patterns that you might have to work hard to relearn and to get comfortable with new ones. But that doesn't, it didn't change who you are. It doesn't define where you can go.
Oh, that's fascinating, Dr. Hawk. And so how would you start if this person came into your, you know, booked a consult with you and ask this question?
Yeah, well, we'd have a very similar conversation. It's sort of like, well, you know, how do you think these things are? Like, tell me about what kind of problems you have in your life right now and how they were created by this abuse that you went through, and let's kind of question that. Let's really talk about, you know, what is stopping you from having a successful relationship? What is stopping you from thriving in your career? Is it really the fact that you suffered this abuse, and were left homeless and had all these terrible relationships, or are there other things going on? You know, some of the other concepts that we've talked about on the show many times, you know, is there, are there ego traps here? Are there esteem dilemmas? Are, you know, can we think of ways to interpret what we might think of as self-sabotage through a more evolutionary framework of you just trying to save face in the village and not be exposed to failure and seeking pleasure and avoiding pain and all of these basic things that we do to try to feel good and, you know, not show other people our weaknesses that are fundamental to everybody in the village, no matter whether they went through terrible childhood abuse or not.
Fascinating. Thank you so much, Dr. Hawk. So our next question has to do with stress. And I've always appreciated your kind of take on some of the more, I guess what Dr. Lau calls the mystic chip with regards to stress and some of the things you've learned along your journey. But the question is, dear doctors, how do I cope non-destructively with stress? As a quite emotionally unstable yet conscientious person, I find myself stressed a lot of the time. In the past, my way of reacting to stress has been reaching for food. I learned that I stress ate because my body was seeking something to increase my chances of survival and reproduction during an uncertain time. But more recently, after successfully stopping myself from using food to alleviate stress, I have turned to impulse shopping. This also makes sense from an evolutionary perspective, since the things that I buy include jewelry, hair, nail appointments, and clothes, which all enhance my physical appearance and also increase my reproductive success. I was wondering if there's something I could do effectively to soothe stress in the moment that won't make me gain weight or break my bank account. And yes, the food I was eating was low calorie dense food, but as someone with extremely lucky, quote, genetics, yet a perfectionist desire for being stick thin, I still gain weight from eating more than I strictly need. I know you might say to work on my environment more than I do myself and prevent circumstances that cause stress in the first place. For example, most recently, I've been stressed at work over managerial responsibilities and not wanting to disappoint my boss with overseeing day-to-day operations. While being a manager is not something I enjoy, this and other stressful positions pay more and allow me to have more money to spend on the various materialistic trinkets that I desire to make me feel more confident about myself in the dating market.
Well, I would say there's a reason that we call the show Beat Your Genes, right? Like, this is, you've got, the answer to your question is all wrapped up in those last couple of sentences. So you're in a job that you don't enjoy, that causes you a lot of stress, which causes this downstream problem of, quote, self-medicating to try to get a little dopamine into your life, whether it's through food or shopping or whatever. So you're coming with the question of, oh, how can I stop the impulse behavior that is trying to make me feel better, rather than looking at the root cause. You're wanting to treat the symptom instead of the cause. The cause is that you're in the stress-producing job. And you are a creature who is more prone to stress in general. Like, you've observed about your personality, you've got this high conscientious quality to you. And so it's probably going to follow you around no matter what sort of job you're in, but you can minimize it. You can put yourself in circumstances that make that less likely to occur, or it's going to occur less often. And so the example I always use is my very high-strung dog, who I love dearly, who's very emotionally unstable, very agreeable, unstable. It's a lovely combination. And he's, you know, if I were living, well, I've just moved to this really quiet rural area where he's super chill. It's like he's just snoozles all day. He's very happy. He's eating more. You know, he gets to go sniff deer poop. Like, life is pretty good. And so it's only when he hears the mail truck in the driveway that he barks and gets agitated. Where when we're living in the city, there's noise all the time. You know, there's neighbors making noise. There's weird sounds on the street. There's fireworks going off on holidays. And so he's always in this state of hyper, you know, paranoid arousal. He's like, oh my God, what's going on? And it's very stressful for him. So I've put him in a new context. You know, if he were a two-legged dog and he had to work for a living, like, he might have a higher paying job in the city. He might have more opportunities to meet people and to do more exciting things and to have more experiences than he does here, but there's a quality of life that he's able to enjoy in this environment that he can't in that. So this is why you have to look at life in terms of trade-offs. Everything is trade-offs. So what's more important to you, having the materialistic trinkets to display to your potential mates that come from this higher income, or this day-to-day grinding stress of this unpleasant job with responsibilities that you don't like and you don't want that are causing you downstream difficulties with your weight and with your checking account? So you have to look very coldly at these things and do a cost-benefit analysis, even if you have to spreadsheet it out to really determine, okay, there's going to be one direction here where I have to beat my genes. I have to either beat my genes with changing the environment that I'm in that I don't want to be in because I'm better compensated for it, or I have to beat my genes in redirecting this nervous self-medication energy into yet another, hopefully less destructive channel. And so you can weigh those out and think about them, but that's the kind of situation that you're in. And it sounds to me like you already sort of know the solution is that you really are not particularly well suited for this job.
Wow. So, Dr. Hawk, do you find yourself less stressed now that you're in Virginia and away from all the noise?
Oh, yeah. No, this is a way better environment for me. I am a country mouse through and through. So, I've been going on walks and you just stop and all you can hear is the occasional drone of a faraway airplane and little birds chirping. And I'm obsessed with foraging and identifying all the plants and trees around. So I just walk around with my little notebook and my little ID books trying to figure out, okay, what is that? Is that poisonous or is that edible? So it's been it's a really good environment for me.
Got some tough decisions when we're trying to beat our genes.
Yeah, no, it's never. I mean, it's not supposed to be easy. You have to pay the cost somewhere. It's not as if you get to elude the cost entirely and find some magical solution where it's completely cost free and super easy. That it really just doesn't work that way most of the time. You have to choose which bill you pay, essentially.
All right, Dr. Hawk. So you want to go for one more?
Sure. What else do we have?
Okay, dear doctors, if I had to put a label on it, I identify as a bisexual female. I'm overthinking applying the evolutionary psychology or EP concepts that I understand so well when it comes to dating women. For instance, do the 10 paid dates still apply when two women are dating? In my experience, relationships with women move much faster than with men, and I've never had an issue pair bonding with females. But I'm now in my late 20s and recently reconnected to a woman I met over 5 years ago. We were in overlapping friend groups, hung out often, we had an interest in one another, but never acted on it because we were always dating other people. But over the years, she would text me a couple times a year, checking in, and this year it's progressed more because we are both single. We live in different states, text often, it's light, it's fun, there's obvious attraction. The plan is for me to visit, but I'm aware that things could be very different in person versus online, so we'll see what happens. But I find myself overthinking how I should go about this. I'll be staying at her place, which is already out of my comfort zone. Is sleeping with her when I visit a bad idea if I desire a relationship rather than a hookup? I normally would never sleep with someone this quickly, but this is an odd situation because of the distance and having known her for many years. Please let me know what you think about this and lesbian relationships in general. I would love to hear a deep dive into your thoughts on women dating women.
Well, I think it's almost, you're violating the spirit of 10 paid dates by moving in just as much as you would be by sleeping with her. So 10 paid dates, the whole notion of the idea of 10 paid dates is really to give both of you a little breathing room to make sure that you're not acting out of distortion and hormones and excitement and esteem, surges of exciting esteem, and all of the things that accompany an early relationship. So, with women dating women, that tendency to immediately play house, you know, all of the U-Haul jokes and everything else, that sort of rushing in very quickly, getting very serious very quickly. It's a slightly different dynamic, but I think all the more important to, you know, try to keep yourself from going all in with this person right away and giving all those signals and looking for all those signals, just to assess, you know, what am I dealing with? What are my real feelings? You know, apart from the thrill of the initial relationship, what is, you know, this person actually about, and what kind of feedback am I really getting? So the fact that you're going to be cohabitating so early is going to give you a lot of information, but it could also contribute to a lot of the early pair bond distortion. So I would say just follow 10 paid dates in the spirit of the law, not necessarily the letter of the law, and give it some time before you bring the sexuality into the relationship, for the same reason that we advise women dating men to do that. There's really not any big difference in the dynamic or in the principle here. It's just about, you know, don't make a big decision when a small decision will do. Take some time to watch your nervous system and you know who this person is and who they become to you over a longer period of time than just getting yourself all wrapped up in a commitment that you don't necessarily want to maintain.
Fascinating. Dr. Hawk, thank you so, so much. We really appreciate it. It's I'm sure we'll hear more about these I really appreciate hearing about these 10 paid dates and the female's perspective in this, because, you know, Lord knows it's both sexes have been confused about it for a while. So
yeah, no, I think the whole idea of 10 paid dates just emerges from this, you know, don't rush into things. It's really, yeah, that's another way that we
10,
can say
it's
it.
Not 9, it's not 11.
Yeah, it's not, there's things. Nothing magical about 10 paid dates, and there's nothing. Yeah, it's really about the, you know, what are you trying to get out of this experience? And, you know, my experience dating women in the past and being around women who date women is that it moves way faster than heterosexual relationships, and that makes the costs of backing out way higher when you get a month or two in, and you're basically already married, and you feel like all of this emotional bondedness that has not necessarily come from a sexual dynamic, it's come from this playing house dynamic, and introducing you to your family members, and you know, just kind of making it very serious very quickly, and you know, over promising to each other what this relationship is about before you actually know what it's about.
Fascinating. Well, Dr. Hawk, thank you so, so much for coming on during this very important political day for you, and not going to a protest.
No, it's fine. I was glad to be able to participate virtually, although it's a little tragic.
Well, hopefully things, hopefully they either improve or go in a better direction. Which, now that I'm thinking about it, is probably the same thing. So
that's sort of like, yeah, I think it's guaranteed to do one. So, yeah, I hope so. I mean, there's some signs of hope. Certainly, looking at, you know, the UK's recent turnaround, the Supreme Court's decision. There's some signs of moving in the right direction, but going back to the high concept of states seizing and consolidating power over their subjects, I think there's still plenty to be worried about. So that's what I'm keeping my eye on.
Yeah. To quote a U.S. official, it's time for us to do what we've been doing, and that time is every day, right?
Jeez. Can't you just see that inscribed on a plaque?
Yeah.
So moving. So just makes me feel very patriotic.
All right, Dr. Hawk. Well, we'll look forward to talking to you and Dr. Lyle very soon. And in the meantime, enjoy Virginia and the peace of your dog.
Yes, I shall do so. Sounds like a plan. I'll talk to you soon, Nate.
Okay, talk to you soon.
All right, bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe. write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.